Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, and welcome to the second of a four-part Listen to Older Voices program on Baby Boomer Simon Rashley. I'm Rob Greaves, and it's a pleasure to share Simon's story with you. Last week we learned that although Simon grew up strongly desiring a higher education, he ended up with an apprenticeship, which ended sooner than he expected, but in turn opened up a pathway into the world of bands and the music retail and promotion business. In this program, Simon talks about how his progressive rock band, Poised for Success, was overtaken by the fast-moving 1970s punk music. Simon moves out of the music business into a more corporate-type position, but music keeps beckoning, and it wasn't long before he was encouraged back to front several groups, one of which was Schism, a band that promised to really explode onto the music scene. But yet again, a lack of real financial return, coupled with other issues, forced Simon out of the artistic area, and he worked really hard to move into the record business, and found himself with a career with Festival Records. This leads to some fascinating stories with Simon's connection with artists such as Alice Cooper and Neil Diamond. We pick up with Simon talking about him changing his stage image to keep pace with the changes in the industry.
So I had got my hair all cut off because it was all long hair, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting right into Peter Gabriel at that stage, as my wannabe sort of figure. But I was starting to write material, like in Wind of You. So the interesting thing from, well, I'm jumping around a bit here in the storyline, but when Penguin United split up, I was approached by a friend, mutual friend, to do this progressive rock band called Wind of You. And that was really significant. I'll come back to the story about Clements in a sec. In Window View, we got to literally record like an album at TCS Studio, same place where the Skyhooks did Living in the 70s. We did a film clip at Swinburne. So we're really moving forward. We had some interest from people. We had an ex-Genesis road manager who had took an interest in us as well. Didn't go anywhere, but things are really moving towards trying to do something. Trouble was, it was during the 70s when punk and new wave had just hit, so we're a little bit late.
Yes.
Yeah, so sailed, really. As much as the music is quite interesting and, you know, I've had friends saying still stands up for what it was at that period, but it was just too late.
But there was also another thing happening at that period with the, again, from the mid-60s through to early to mid-70s, there were a plethora of music venues, you know, you had the Thumping Tum, you had the discos and things everywhere, you know, town halls, old warehouses, everything was coming into the 70s, certainly mid to late 70s, there was the move into the pubs, and then it sort of less and less venues as the pubs then took on gambling more than live music. Were you affected in that sort of changeover or not?
It were affected more that there was that element, as you said. But for a progressive rock band, it was just terrible timing because everyone was getting into new wave and punk, you know, and all the bands were being booked in that sort of sense around the inner city, et cetera. So we were doing outer suburban gigs where we would hire our own hall and put our own show out of the basin or places like that just to try and have some sort of audience. But we weren't going anywhere. It was good stuff. We just missed our timing, you know. But a very funny story comes up, reminds me of Window View. We had really good gear. We had the bass pedals. We had, you know, really good synths, you know, Harp Odysseys, and we had fabulous gear. And we had the rehearsal studio in the city once, and was it North Melbourne? And we just got all this gear, you know. We would have spent about 60 grand's worth of gear, you know, had our own PA system. And we're packing it all up, and there's this punk band that walks in. He's next at the rehearsal studio. It's a band called The Negatives, who was part of that Suicidal Records release. Remember that?
I do.
Yeah. And they came in and they looked at all the gear, and these guys walked in with their guitars. They didn't even have, like, guitar cases. They just carried their guitars down the street, you know, literally. And they came in and went, oh, blimey, what is all this? Pull down the Christmas tree, will you? We want to get started. So that was with, oh, punks, you know. It was quite a funny episode.
Right.
Where there was that sort of clash of cultures.
Yes, and yes.
It was a bit of a wake-up call as I look back thinking, oh, yeah, should we be doing this, you know?
Yes.
Because these guys were the future, you know.
We didn't see it quite that way at that time.
No.
I certainly didn't. This is the future, no. But it was.
But the funny thing is I knew about, even though I was in that progressive rock band, when I was in Clements, I was getting right into the punk new wave side of things as a record buyer. So I was really, a fan of all of the magazine, of Stranglers, Sex Pistols, etc. But as a musician, I was still doing prog.
So that ends your music playing career that period?
No. What happened then is that things, I'll just get back to our story at Clements, when I got a tap on the shoulder to leave in 1980. It was a few things happened. I split up with my longtime girlfriend, Diane. I lost a job and, I was pretty much had nothing going on in my life. And all of a sudden I decided I'll get into the corporate world. So I cut off all my hair. I went and sort of canvassed for jobs, etc. And I got a job as a chewing gum salesman for Wrigley's Chewing Gum.
That's a change. As a sales rep,
yeah. But it was great because I got a company car.
Ah.
And
a decent wage, probably.
And a really good wage. I even got offered to be sales manager of Papua New Guinea at one point. But I did pretty well in that career. And then I got my own place out in Burwood, you know. So I had money, I had a place. Mm. Other new relationships were on the go. And things were going quite well in that sort of corporate world when one day the drummer from Windowview came and tapped me and said, oh, we've got this idea for a band. You want to come and join with us? Pull me back in. Oh, it's going to be interesting. And I said, oh, I don't know if I want to do a prog thing again. He said, no, it's going to be more new wave, more interesting, you know, what we'll do. Anyway, so I went and checked it out and I got right into it again. And that band was probably the most significant band of my career, a band called Schism. Schism did very well for itself.
Yes.
Schism played alongside The Birthday Party, In Excess, you know, same stage, Dead Can Dance. There's all that whole Jump Club, Crystal Ballroom era, Real Life Shooter Echo, Kids in the Kitchen, a whole heap of them. And we were, you know, getting good gigs through premier artists and, I think with Nucleus as well at one stage. So we're on the up and up.
Mm.
We did a cassette album, which sold pretty well in the little indie circles. Some of them went to Japan and Germany as well, so it sold over there. So, you know, we're moving into something. So Schism, the early Schism was sort of different to the later Schism. Early Schism was like post-punk prog when I look at it. It had a really interesting sort of feel to it. And, we got a few gigs. We did this cassette album. We had the difficulty trying to get beyond that, trying to get any attention because we're a little bit different in what we're doing. So we decided at some point with all the neuromantic thing happening and et cetera over in the UK, and plus my then wife, who had got married, she was an ex-Blitz Scene from London girl. So she knew Steve Strange and Spandau Ballet and Boy George and all that. So she was also a bit of an influence for me in Schism is my makeup artist and encouraging our style direction. So we sort of moved from that sort of post-punk prog, very theatrical band thing. And my name was Simon Circus then as a performer. And we evolved more into a slicker sort of synth pop sort of outfit, more sort of Ultravox kind of thing in what we're doing. And that's just the cassette album we did was more of that second era, as I mentioned.
Here's an example of the music of Schism. First of all, a piece of Steam associated with the very early Schism, and then a latter Schism track called Pray Pray. We'll be right back. Listen to Older Voices. The Magic of Memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Simon Rashley, and Simon is talking about the continuing evolution of his group Schism during that post-punk period.
But then we had a situation where we had a falling out with a keyboard player, and we split as a band, and so then we became as a band called Illustration. And Illustration did similar sort of gigs. We probably didn't get the same support from the industry. We're a little bit different again. We were probably channeling in our sound a more contemporary sound in synths. Like you can hear, listening, like you can hear Scritti Politti in there, you can hear Depeche Mode, you hear Yellow Magic Orchestra. You know, so it's really interesting influences we're bringing in. It was probably a little bit before its time.
The other thing that I think probably you suffered from by the sound of it, that I think groups certainly in the some very big name groups in the early 70s through to the 80s suffered from, and that is the tyranny of size of audiences in Australia. You can have so many different style bands, but you don't have the audience numbers. Yeah. In Europe, you can have so many different styles because the audiences are massive.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you suffered from that. You just
I think
find the numbers.
What we should have done, we probably should have, you know, done what some of other Melbourne underground musicians have done, went over to Europe and would have been a...
It's a hard one. It's hard. Yeah. It's a hard gig being a musician in Australia.
Yeah. So that was a really interesting time for me. This is, we're talking the early 80s here. Mm. And so Illustration, again, did recordings, et cetera, got some good press. We were headlining our own shows around some of the inner city clubs like Hosey's Hotel. And, it just didn't quite get
the next level.
Mm. And then our keyboard player, Steve Williams, he was an extremely talented guy. And then, of course, he was headhunted. And he was asked to join other bands, et cetera, and so he was really torn.
Mm.
In the end, he left to become backline keyboard player for Shooter Wacko.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, he became the permanent replacement in real life for Richard Zatorski. So Zatorski left real life. And then Steve, funnily enough, I played with both keyboard players in real life. He joined real life and then toured the world. So I don't blame him. He's like a great career opportunity. Why wouldn't you? But that essentially was the end of Illustration at that point. And I started to pick up guitar and try and do things myself. I thought, oh, look, I've really got to get on with my career life. You know, I had my wife, we'd married then, and, you know, I really thought I nearly need to get on in life. So I decided to try and get into the record game. I'd actually been trying a few times along the way. After Wrigley's, I'd worked for Tandy Electronics for a little bit, but I always wanted to get in the record game. So I kept applying and wasn't having much luck there. And then one day a role came up at Festival Records to be a trainee rep and warehouse assistant. So I went down there and just turned up. As soon as it was advertised, rang up, said, sorry, I'm not taking any more applications. It was like 2 minutes after he said to ring at 9 a.m. So I said, that can't be. So I drove down there at Drill Street and Festival, and I said to them, I'm here for the job. Sorry, we closed applications. Well, I'm not leaving here till I get an interview. And I literally planted myself in reception and refused to leave until I got an interview. So obviously they came around and said, all right, we'll have a chat to you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an interview, and I did the big spiel and talked about the Clements days and, you know, being a music buyer and how I knew some of the guys here already, you know. And I got the job.
Wow.
Festival Records. So,
and puts then, far work sometimes.
Yeah. So my life then took another major turn then. That's when I was really getting into the bigger part of the music industry, and what came next was quite large for me. So from that point, as we're talking about 1985 now, not in bands, living with my wife in South Yarra, I haven't got a family yet, started still doing a bit of thing on the guitar, and had a Tascam recorder, etc., still trying to do something maybe later on. And then at Festival Records, I moved up in the ranks, became country rep, I became suburban rep, I became city rep, and doing very well there, and worked with some amazing artists. It was a real heyday of Festival too, when they had A&M Records, Chrysalis, Island, Arista, as well as Mushroom and Regular. You know, so I had a fabulous collection of catalogs and labels and stuff. Met some amazing artists and really got to work on some brilliant stuff.
We talk about international or just
international as well. As a rep, you know, like I remember myself and another rep, John Mills, we were instrumental for getting people like Whitney Houston in the charts in Melbourne, and that launched her career in Australia. Things like that. So you got lots of stories of things like that that we worked on as a team. Anyway, I got to the point festival where I was, you know, wanted to move forward in the next level, which was promotions. And we're getting into the sort of later 80s here. And they gave me a shot at going up to Sydney for a bit and looking after MTV and a few things as a bit of a trial thing. But I never got the breakthrough where I actually got the position. And then a role came up at CBS Records. And I applied as promotions rep. And I got the gig at CBS Records. So then I moved, jumped ship from festival, ran across to CBS Records, working under the tutelage of Paul Barker, who was an amazing promo guy and great person to learn from, and really developed myself at CBS Records, which later became Sony Music, where I became promotions manager myself. I'll just rewind a bit, though, about another part of my life which I haven't mentioned yet. So around about 1987, when I was still at festival, our house got burgled in Clifton Hill, and we lost all our stuff. So I lost a guitar, I lost all my recordings. No. Oh. So that kind of, to me, was like a bit of a death knell to the musician part of me. It's like, oh, you know, all the stuff was stolen. So my recordings, everything.
I mean, that would have been the killer, wouldn't it? I mean, you can replace the guitar, but you can't replace the recordings.
And I just lost faith then from that. But with the check that we got back from the insurance, me and my wife, Sue, we went to Europe. Had a fabulous time in Europe and, you know, did the big European holiday, a bit of Japan as well. So, you know, I put it to good use. And then...
Were there any particular highlights of that trip together?
Look, it was mainly typical touristy stuff from the 80s. You know, we just did all the usual stuff, bit of Switzerland, lots of France, England.
But does anything stand out for you? Did you have a highlight? Was there a place or an event that you look back and go, that was the best? Or was it all just fairly...
It was all amazing, particularly at France and Italy and Switzerland, I particularly loved, you know. I could have stayed longer, but we only had 6 weeks.
Is this tying back to your early love of art, literature, things? I mean, was it the going back to the, you know, you mentioned France and Italy, which are the homes of architecture and art per se. Was that what...
That was certainly drawn out, came out of me in that appreciation. One thing I haven't mentioned in this conversation is going back, and I've skipped over this bit, that between my band Penguin United and Window View, there was a period there right through that sort of late 70s where I really got stuck into academic activity, reading up on all sorts of things. My mind couldn't stop. Philosophy, psychology, other sciences like geology. So I just really picked up anything I could get my hands on and really developed my mind. And that spark from the White Fries days sort of came through again, where I really developed my mind. Mm. That also really helped me bring out sort of more individual traits as an art music artist. When I was in Schism and Illustration, I realized I'd become more my own person. I mentioned before that I saw earlier on that Ian Gillan was my sort of hero in the early days, and then Peter Gabriel. But then around about the 80s when I got into Schism, I was my own person then. Mm. I didn't draw from anyone. You can still see the influences coming through, whether it be Gabriel or a bit of Howard DeVito or Brian Eno, et cetera. But I was my own artist as Simon Circus, you know, doing my own thing then. So I was very much an independent artist. But that all came from, I suppose, the integration of all that sort of learning, studying. Mm. On my own, I didn't go through uni or anything like that. I mean, did get to go to uni years later. We'll get to that. But it really brought out that artistic part of me. We can see in the lyrics and stuff.
So when you came back from the trip, I mean, it's could almost be flippant to say, oh, you know, we just did the touristy thing. But it sounds to me as though it actually did have an impact on you.
It did have an impact,
Did that affect how you saw things when you came back to Australia, or did it just encourage you to go?
It gave me more of a global perspective to finally, you know, visit some of these key things that I'd read about or, you know, wanted to know more about. So it did, I suppose, give me a certain edge of worldliness, you know, having been there. Because we, you know, we really hit the museums and things like that around the place. So,
so what did you do for work when you came back?
I had leave at festival. So luckily, I had leave, so I didn't have to lose the festival job. But I just wanted to mention that trip and what happened, because it was probably more a key point in the story that I'd lost the gear, even though I got to have a trip. And that really then set my path of putting aside the musician.
Simon is the musician.
Simon's done that. Still lives on inside.
Yeah.
But then very much became the record company man.
Yep.
And really moved into that. So having done that and really worked hard on the career side of things, things became very significant for me when I became promotions manager of Sony Music Entertainment, working on some really amazing acts.
That's a fairly senior position, isn't it?
It was. You know, I was looking after major tours coming into town, taking it to media. You know, I got to meet some major icons, you know, spent a week with Ozzy Osbourne, you know, and Alice Cooper.
That was some of your heroes.
Well, I told Alice about the original time I heard Skills Out, and he said, oh, wow, that's amazing, you know. Yeah.
Listen to Older Voices, where stories from the past find a home in the present.
And I really want to hear another very funny side story about Alice Cooper. When I got into Alice Cooper as a teen and used to play it, I used to drive my mother insane. You know, she was really almost on the edge, you know. So years later, when I'm working at Sony, and I say, hey, Mum, guess who I'm looking after this week? And she said, who, love? I said, Alice Cooper. She said, Alice Cooper, wow, can you do me a favor? And when you see him, can you strangle him for me? Right? So anyway, I'm cruising around Melbourne, this beautiful black stretch Cadillac with Alice Cooper, right? And we've just done a series of interviews, and we're talking about, you know, going out for dinner and stuff. It was a real rock star trip, you know. Mm. But that was my life, you know. I said to Alice, hey, Alice, we've talked about how, you know, write into music and your icon form. He said, yeah. I said, when I told my mother that I was looking after this week, you know what she said? He said, why? He said, well, when you see Alice, can you strangle him for me? He said, oh, wow. He said, okay, Simon, give me one of those promo photos. So I gave him the promo photo, and he got out the old gold tips texter, and he wrote on the photo, to Joan, my mother, to Joan, from your long-lost son, Alice. And when I gave her the photo, she was so embarrassed. She was so embarrassed. Oh, you didn't tell him, did you? Oh, no. It was just a great moment.
Oh, dear. That is a wonderful story.
I've got so many stories like that, you know. Mm. And then Ozzy, I met Dylan, I met Johnny Cash.
Because most of us who don't have the opportunity to meet him have an image of these people being very standoffish and very isolated and separate from the rest of the world.
Oh.
It doesn't sound like there was
the case. Oh, look, you really get to see them when they take their mask off, you know. A classic case in point, Neil Diamond. So I had Neil Diamond at down Hey Hate Saturday, and we're doing the, you know, the performance there with Daryl and Ozzy, et cetera. And it's during the LA riots when Rodney King was beaten up. And anyway, Neil Diamond's house was actually in the vicinity of the LA riots. Mm-hmm. He was very concerned.
Mm.
And back in those days, we had the big brick mobiles, you know.
Gotcha.
So it had to fit in your pocket. So anyway, he was feeling really uneasy because he's worried about his family, and he's about to do hey. I said, well, would it help if we, you know, made a call and just check in? So, oh, that would be wonderful. So he gave him the mobile. He rang LA, checked with his family, and they're all okay. But it was really interesting. You got to see the mask come off Neil Diamond and see him as this little man talking, is everyone okay? You know, not like the all-American rock star hero.
Yes,
and
yes.
You got to see him in his vulnerable state.
Family man.
Yeah. And it's really quiet, and it was a different person. It's amazing.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, we gave him props, so we're trying not to listen in, but we couldn't help it.
Yeah.
And he finishes a call, hands back, says, thank you very much. And then almost twists his neck, and then bang
back into
the rock star's back.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Join Simon and myself next week for part 3 of his story, which involves working with both Festival Records and Sony, and of his meeting with both local and overseas artists such as AC/DC and Ozzy Osbourne, and of career changes into both the TV and film production industries. That's Simon Rashley next week on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.